This is CliffCentral.com.
Renegade Reports. I'm Jonathan.
And Romani's president. And Jonathan's back from the Republic of Cape Town. Did you find your plot of land that you'll build your bunker in?
I have claimed my land, because give me the land. Hashtag.
From who? Was it a white family or a colored family?
I believe a black guy who's building in Fresno. He was building a 20 million rand house. I think his name's Cyril.
I think it's 100 million.
Is it?
Well, it was before.
Sorry, the property's worth 20 million. It's the house on top of it. That's then 100 bar. Yeah, so I have claimed my property there in Fresno, just overlooking the Atlantic. Beautiful, beautiful spot.
Well, I'm very glad. I think you went in, it's not an invasion. You just knocked on the door.
It's expropriation without compensation, Ramon. We've decided we are amending the Constitution and. Seems reasonable to me.
So they may as well start.
Yeah.
I think it would be a good idea if the president does that first before anyone else.
Well, gives up some of his land.
Absolutely.
Well, as one of the richest landowners in the country, it only seems reasonable. I mean, I think we should start with his land and then just hit his bank account straight. That seems completely fair.
That's property too. Talking about expropriation, I see, who are they? Oh, yes. The EFF have to pay AfriForum R500,000.
Yeah, and supposedly they're going to attach assets, or is that separate?
Or
when they don't pay, they'll have
to retrieve the R500,000. They have to attach tables and chairs and laptops
and Breitling watches
and berets and Jaguar F types. I think they're F type. I don't know.
Imagine you win this court case, and then all you get out of it is a whole bunch of boxes of red berets. I mean, that is somewhat disappointing, but the moral victory is great either way. What can you do with the red beret? It'd be quite funny if AfriForum were to rebrand the red berets. You know, just throw them in the wash a couple of times till they go like orange.
Yeah, there we go. Then they become AfriForum berets. I think they're wonderful.
Remarkable, remarkable.
Well, I mean, let's bring our guest in.
Sure.
Lifting hanging here. Mr. Wayne Duvenage from Outer. Welcome, sir.
Nice to be with you guys.
So it is Duvenage, not Duvenacher.
Doesn't really matter. We're in this multicultural, multiracial.
If you're an Afrikaans donor, Duvenacher.
Duvenacher. Yeah, exactly. It's Duvenage, English, and Duvenage is French. So
yes, indeed. There's four iterations of the name. I mean, try have the name Ramon in South Africa. I get about six different interpretations. Yeah, I just accept all of them.
Exactly.
It's easier. So. Organization against tax abuse. Why not theft abuse? Because I mean, taxation is theft.
No,
at the end of the day,
it goes into the same. But tax abuse also happens with gross maladministration, real waste, and so yeah, it covers a broader range.
Does it though? I mean, I think personally, all tax is theft, irrespective of its. Well, used or not.
Yeah, that's a discussion. It's a longer discussion for probably another time. I mean, how do you run a country without taxes?
But you don't. That's the key. We don't want a country.
You're dealing with an anarchist, so he's going to be.
We've had lots of different. I tell you, we get mails daily from people who've got brilliant and good ideas of how to administer and run their nations, and they're all interesting. But at the moment, we have this situation. And if we can just stop the abuse, we can do so much more.
How did this happen? Because essentially, as far as I understand, you were CEO of a relatively large company, a car hire company. And then the government decided to retar some roads, which is kind of their job. At least it currently is their job. And... they sold it to us as some sort of great improvement to the roads. Mm-hmm. I used those roads before they did the improvement project. Yeah. It's bullshit. On some roads, we got one extra lane. Yeah. That was what we got. And then in return for that, we were going to pay a toll, which originally, some people might forget this, was going to be for 9 years, and then the toll was going to disappear. You'll notice no one talks about that anymore. Yeah. You came out against it, I think, as a private citizen, and Arta didn't exist. So how do we get you?
Look, the short story is being the CEO of an organization was going to be impacted massively by a tolling system, an electronic one, because you have to have interfaces with their systems. You have to be able to dispute bills when people ride on your number plates, clone number plates. You have to get your bill to the customer who's just flown out after going through a gantry 3 minutes ago. And so we were quite surprised that we learned after the road, after the decision had been taken, the roads had been upgraded, suddenly right at the end, these gantries appear and Nazir Ali appears on the radio and says, no, we've got this lovely plan. Don't worry. You don't have to stop at these boom down gantries. Just drive now and pay later. And it works like this. You put a tag on your car, you register with our system, and you just keep money in our bank account. And I thought, my goodness, how is it possible that the biggest fleet owners, because I phoned all the car rental guys, the Road Freight Association, so nobody knew what was going on. So we engaged with Sandra. We sat down and said, just tell us what you're trying to do here. And the more we engaged, the more we learnt about a system that was absolutely inefficient, costly, it was irrational, it was just unjust. And it was unjust because government has other options and other ways of financing roads, and they are so more efficient and easy to apply. And you've got to ask yourself, why does government choose a very difficult, cumbersome, expensive scheme over current options that have zero administration costs, 100% compliance, and if they had have applied them by today here, we would have sat with the capital paid off. So that's just the two things. You say, if you've got two choices, why choose the difficult, costly one? And when you look deeper and deeper, you can see exactly what's happening. This is money that is flowing into companies offshore, flowing into suppliers to that company here in South Africa, massive administration costs. It is a gross overstatement. I mean, our latest research shows that Sanral would have got 34% of its revenue. 34% of its revenue from 1% of its road surface. So that is abusing a very concentrated 186-kilometer road users. Mm. It just is absolute nonsense. And I got pissed off with this, seriously. I took it personally because it just, when you don't make sense, when you don't go through your processes as government by engaging properly and giving people the opportunity, as our constitution requires, to influence decisions like this, to deal with congestion in other ways, because this is not just about widening a freeway network by one lane. That gets congested within 7 years. It's about making sure it interlinks with transport systems, public transport systems. That's how you deal with congestion. And so we could see this was going to be a mess. And it's exactly that. It has become the mess that we anticipated.
All right. So that's how ARTA gets born.
Well, then we formed the Opposition to Urban Tolling Alliance. I headed up the Savrola, the Car Rental Association. We got together and said, guys, something's wrong. Are we going to challenge this or aren't we? For the first time, business stood together and said, yes, we need to challenge this because it was fundamentally flawed. Then we set up the challenge. We successfully interdicted the launch, and then government started putting pressure on our supporters, which was business at the time. They all ran for the hills. ARTA was left high and dry, millions of rands with bills, and we had to take a new tack. We had to go to the people, and this is actually – this, you know, in hindsight, good stuff. It's about how does civil society become relevant to the real people, and it is the people. This is protecting the small guys. This is not protecting business at all. And so we had to reinvent ourselves. We had to turn to the public, and that's when it starts to work. Is when hundreds of thousands and tens of thousands of people give you small amounts of money in a donation, a debit order once a month, you become able to empower this organization that empowers people. So we then went from not making lawyers rich because we employed our own legal team. We're able to work faster. We're able to work smarter. And researchers, investigators, communication specialists, and project managers. We put that together, and then we answered the call to a lot of our supporters saying, but go beyond tolls. You know, why are you just dealing with a toll thing? And it was a very valid question. So we did. Since then, we've done in 2016 when we changed the name from Opposition Urban Tolling Alliance to Organization Undoing Tax Abuse, keeping that same acronym and aptly describing what we do. We took our team from a 3-man team to a 50-person team. and we've taken on another 107 projects. And those other 107, aside from tolling, which is one project, it's still our big focus project, those other 107 projects deal with the fight against corruption and maladministration of state funds, our funds. And we have stopped Bank of Baroda money from, the mine rehabilitation funds, Gupta's one's going offshore, 1.8 billion rand. We have a case against Dudumnyeni as a delinquent director. We've stopped BNP Capital, these boutique little finance houses being enriched by SAA's boards. And as I say, 108 projects, some of them quick, and 60 of those are still in progress right now. And the ones that we have closed, we have got a 78% success rate.
So let's go back to when business dropped you guys out. As an ex-CEO, what is wrong with big business in this country in terms of being absolutely cowardly when the state does anything?
Yeah,
they're the first ones to jump on board. They're the first ones to say, no, we will help you implement this.
And this is more than half a century problem. Was a problem in the past 8 years.
It's not a new problem. But what is up with these unscrupulous people that have to latch on to state power at all costs? I mean, is it just a greed thing? Is it just a fear thing? Like, as someone who was in that that arena, what do you think it is?
I think it is greed, and I'll tell you why. It is, the reality is that big business has got this pyramid shape where a few people at the top make massive decisions for every organization. And those few people at the top earn massive salaries and bonuses. And the more you make and your shareholders are happy, the more you pay yourself, the more you make decisions to earn a fat bonus. And so if you're okay, if your walls are high enough, if your kids are in private schools and your money goes offshore, you actually stop giving a shit about the real people, that is the people that work in your organization, the people in society that are affected by your decisions. You become blinkered to the reality of what businesses' roles should be. And it's very rare that you get businesses that go beyond the boundaries of business as usual, that go beyond and see, this is my impact. This is my impact as a business leader, and this is our impact as executives of this organization on society. And if we take a different tack, if we spend a little bit more money in other areas, we will have a bigger impact on society. And so you see it in all areas. Just take the sustainability space. If every company spent money on being carbon neutral, in other words, reducing its emissions and creating new projects that were going to reduce the harm on the environment, but not only that, create jobs and employment for people in this country through those processes, and you can do them very cleverly. You'll reduce your profitability maybe by a million or two in a big organization. That might not be much. In others, it might be a bit more. But let's take 5% reduction in profitability, and you make massive impacts in society. What do those people do at the top? They look the other way. They make excuses for their impact not being so bad. And they will rather put that money into their own pockets. And that's the blinkered, selfish, unfortunate outcome of business. And when they all start behaving like that, they start to justify. And I can tell you, I had memos and mails from heads of business backing this outer initiative because we showed them what was so fundamentally wrong with ETOLs. And within 2 weeks, the Politburo, I call them, these are the government officials that sit on those boards. Within 2 weeks, I got mails from every single car rental company, which is owned by the big players, saying, I'm sorry, we have to pull out. We can't support you anymore. And I said, why? What's going on here? And quickly worked out what was going on. Saw the memos from SANRAL to government saying, put pressure on these car rental companies and their owners, the Barloworlds and the Imperial Groups and the Bidvests of the world and CMH, put pressure on them to stop funding out, otherwise they will lose government business. And that's exactly what happened. That is cowardly. That is sick. And that's an unfortunate reality of business.
I think this speaks to an important part of ethics. And I, You know, I find it interesting because I hold an opinion that in an unethical society, in an unethical country, it is very difficult to do business, certainly at the top level, without buying into an unethical system. So a lot of people will criticize KPMG, who got caught doing the Gupta's bidding. They will criticize VBS now, who got caught doing the Gupta's bidding. Well, it was essentially a banking shell for the Guptas. But in my opinion, if you were able to start searching through the records in any other large accounting auditing firm, if you were to go into any of the other banks that hold municipal accounts, I am not convinced that you wouldn't find similar corruption. And for the very simple reason that in a corrupt society where things are done based on corrupt relationships, you have to make a choice. Either you're going to be ethical and you're going to earn less money and you're not going to get the contracts and the tenders and the deals and all of that, or you buy into the system. I don't know what I've had the counter said to me, no, you can still be an ethical businessman. What's your take?
Well, you hit the nail on the head because that's what we're seeing. And it's almost a case of these guys will sit around the table, the boardroom table. A big deal can go down here. And they justify doing it by saying, if we don't do it, someone else is going to do it. That's what happens. And literally they say, so how can we make it happen, in inverted commas, that it looks cool, looks okay? Oh, we'll set up a nice empowerment organization here. And one guy, it's called shiny seat tendering. They don't get off their seats. They just sit behind a computer and they become massively rich because the money just flows through one name with 100% BE rating. And he gets his Ferrari, as you say, and he looks good, and the company and the business and the people out there suffer. It's a sick, actually. So this is how business justifies it. And what we do need, and there are businesses out there that do it, what we do need is real strong ethical leadership that says, not on our watch. We won't do this. This is the unethical route, and we're prepared to lose the business. And very few can do that, because what they're actually saying is, I'm prepared to lose my bonus.
Yeah.
And that's where the greed comes in. And I'm earning enough. Do I need my bonus if we're not going to hit our targets because we didn't do this job? And that's where they look away and they find all the excuses. It's sad, actually.
So, yeah. So, I mean, let's talk about Outset now. So you were forced to actually go to the public and ask for a monthly donation. This has become a very popular method of funding organizations. I mean, I think AfriForum started first in 2006, and they've grown massively. They've got 220,000. You have a few tens of thousands. Institute of Race Relations also starting. Politics Web is starting as well. So a lot of institutions are looking towards ordinary members of the public for small donations in volume over time, and these have replaced enormous corporate sponsorship budgets and things like that. Now that you've done both, you've been on both sides of that scale, the shareholder scale and the public scale, how difficult is it to actually keep your members not happy, but to execute their mandate effectively, as opposed to being a big CEO of a company with shareholders? What are the differences there?
It's two totally different things. First of all, you're selling. You're not selling a product. You're selling hope. You're selling vision. You're selling a connection that a person will have to a cause. And they've got to decide, is this worth funding or not? And it's very often people don't even know that you need their funding, that you don't just exist out of thin air, that you require money to pay salaries. And our problem initially was that we were allowing people to give us once-off donations, and people were saying, great, I've donated. But we couldn't attract good people. We made a fundamental decision. I'll come back to the question. But for us, the formula was about, you've got to find the best people. That's like any business. That is so apt in civil activism. You've got to find the right people, and the right people are not necessarily volunteers. These are people you've got to attract out of business, and they need market-related salaries. So we've stopped feeling guilty about the fact that we have to pay salaries to do this work. You've got to, and they have to be market-related. Secondly, the right people, right structures. You've got to pay rent. You've got to pay data costs. So this is monthly. So we had to then say to our supporters out there, don't give us once-off donations because you cannot run this organization on once-off payments. What we would rather than give us 1,000 rand every now and then or every year, give us 100 rand a month. Because now we've got continuity, we've got equity, there's income coming in, and we know exactly what we can do and how far we can budget and go. That was the fundamental shift. And it was almost, it's a hard decision to say to somebody who wants to give you once-off. You know, it's almost better to lose 20%. So 2 in 10 people saying, no, if you don't want to take my once off, I'm not going to give you. And force the other 8 who wanted to do the same thing into saying, okay, I'll agree to the smaller monthly amount. It's not arrogance. It's just you, this is a business model. That's the only way you can do it, actually. And we learned that a bit late. You know, we could have been 3 years ahead of where we are and a long way down this road. But that's fine. That's life. And here we are. 2016, changed our name, changed our brand, changed our funding methodology, had tough times getting the right people into the organization, having to move out of the organization, people that were hijacking it, that were just trying to take this organization into totally different areas, had to dismiss directors, people like that. I mean, this is harder. I promise you, it's been harder running an organization of 50 people than an organization of 2,000. Also because we've had to put, you know, policy, process, structure in place and learning as you go. So it's been really, really exciting journey. So if I can compare the two, this has been tougher, but it's been far more rewarding. I mean, you know, corporate life is, if you're there and you're performing, you get comfortable and you get your car and you've got your fancy office and you've get your bonuses and your lacquer increases every year. This is hard. You work hard for your money. You're exhausted. You know, when the media wants you on a Sunday in the studio, the media are the best form of getting civil activism's message out there. You are at their beck and call, and we have a policy: if the media phones in at midnight, you answer the call. So we are there. We are in the evenings and weekends, up early to do these interviews, so that we can share the story, the real story of what it means to do activism and activism properly. And we haven't got it right all the time. We make the odd mistake, but I think 90% of the time, I can tell you we've got fantastic people. This is all about people, nothing else. People with a passion to do things right.
Okay, so it's motivating and a good stump speech. Mm. You know, so you've gone after the tolling thing. Where are we on tolling? Let's maybe just go there quickly.
Just very briefly, 5 years into the scheme, it peaked after 6 months after threatening the public with criminal records and so forth. It peaked at 40% compliance. These schemes in our research shows around the world, 80% or less fails.
Hmm.
They fail because if you cannot enforce and chase the money on the 20%, the 80% get pissed off with the fact that 20% aren't paying. And that becomes, 21% and 22%, and government can't chase them. And so in Portugal, Texas, Manchester, Edinburgh, these schemes have failed, but they've worked well in other countries and other places. So you've got to ask yourself why. Where does it work and where doesn't it work? And this one ticked all the boxes of why it wouldn't work. Didn't have the public engagement, doesn't have the systems, the reliance on the e-natus, which is inefficient, postal services. So you add up, and again, as I said, you've got these two options. Why do you do this, Mr. Government? So 5 years on, the scheme is down to 25% compliance. And now they're about to relaunch it again. So it's paused. It's going to reset. I might even offer an amnesty. Everybody will write off the debt, but please from here on, come with us. And if you don't, we're going to withhold your licenses because we're now going to bring in a new ARTA amendment. And I just sit here and say, is this how you want to run a country? You know, when you've got the best options, you want to beat your people. So it's going to fail. It's going to maybe have another resurgence because a little while ago they offered a 60% discount. They got a 1% growth in their compliance and it's dropped off again. So this is going to probably get people saying, gee, okay, all my debt can be written off, and they can start again. And they might get 50% compliance, and 3 years down the line, we'll sit here again exactly where we are.
So let me just get into some of the nitty-gritty there. Firstly, is it true that after 3 years, I think it is, the debt prescribes?
Yeah.
So, you know, if you've got...
If you haven't got the bills, and a lot of people haven't got the bills, and they haven't given you notice that they want that money, it prescribes, yeah. And that's prescribing right now, every day, 3 years ago.
Yeah, people, okay. So that's the one thing that is correct. What of something like an amendment where you can't get your driver's license? That seems like something that might work. I mean, give another example that we're forced to do, our car license discs. Those go up every year for no reason. You walk into a room, you pay an amount of money, no one checks the vehicle. The vehicle may have been roadworthy 20 years earlier. It could literally have been in three major accidents since then. It may have no headlights, but no one checks it. As long as you pay them your money, you get a disc. And if you don't use the disc, then your insurance company will reject your claim if you have an accident.
No,
so everyone, oh, is that not true?
No, it's not true. So let me just explain the whole vehicle license. Vehicle licensing is right. The fact that they've pushed this envelope so far, and not giving the benefits of good traffic in cities and towns and traffic lights and road quality, that's the concern, because that money should be used for that. But it's right to license your vehicle. Now, vehicle licenses and vehicle revenue from vehicle licenses impacts local taxes. Must understand this. And national tolling impacts national issues. So it's unlawful. It's like me saying, well, if you don't pay a TV license, I'm going to switch off your electricity. You can't do that. And the local authorities will look to the national and say, you can't do this. You're impacting on our revenue stream here. So that's unlawful, just for a start. Secondly, if they want to even go down that road, all they're going to do is force people to say, fine, then I won't relicense my vehicle. Now you've got another problem. And we've spoken to the insurance companies. If you don't have a license disc on your vehicle, that's not a prerequisite to pay your to have your claims. Here's exactly why. If I drive with smooth tires on my car, and I am in the rain and I have an accident, my car's not roadworthy, the insurance company won't pay out. But if I have smooth tires on my car and somebody rear ends me, the fact that I've got smooth tires is not the consequences of that accident, and I have to pay out. And this is the discussion. We've had serious discussions with insurance companies. Because by the way, Sanral bought this ploy right in the beginning. Well, if you don't, you're not going to get insurance.
Yeah.
And that was rubbish. So, no. It's just,
and driver's licenses, which you alluded to?
No, they can't. Because a driver's license has got nothing to do with the fact. I mean, that'll be tested in court, and you would know constitutionally. You can't withhold my driver's license because I've got a valid debt that I'm disputing with Sanral because they haven't fixed this query that I had 2 months ago. Why should I pay for a service where I'm not being served properly? So that's a totally different argument. You can't now say, well, just settle it and then we'll give you your license. So you will get your licenses. Your car has to be licensed. Constitutionally, we will take those cases on. And government must understand that if they start doing this irrational process, they just force people to stop having vehicle licenses. And the ramifications and unintended consequences of that is too big to contemplate. So don't go there, government, because if you want to, you make your problem bigger.
All right. And they say that we have no real consumer advice to give to our listeners, but there we go. So now you know, if you don't license your car, you'll still get insurance claim paid out.
Yeah.
I don't know that.
Yeah, I mean, on that license disc thing, it's a more philosophical debate, but I would at least be happier with it. You know, somewhere like the United States makes you take the vehicle into a testing center pretty much on an annual basis.
Yeah, you know, roadworthiness is a whole another issue. I mean, just stop vehicles.
If that's what I was paying for, I might go, not that I like it, but at least you're checking my vehicle, you're checking the other guy's vehicle. All right, I'm probably safer on the road as a result of it. Maybe I make that
exactly.
argument.
Look,
but at the moment,
look at what your licensed vehicle money goes to managing and paying towards a local municipality and a metro.
Yes.
That employs metro police, that stop vehicles that are going through red traffic lights.
Yeah.
That are stopping vehicles that are unroadworthy, doing the check where your indicator is not working, please get it fixed. Now, that's how it should be done. But unfortunately, you and I drive behind cars every day. No brake lights. completely unroadworthy. Why police are not doing their job? Why? Well, just get look into that.
Yeah. So private testing centres would be a much better answer for me.
Well, private everything. I think even licensing fees are theft. At the end of the day, I think that's something you should fight on.
You need to become a donor, Ramon.
I'm sure he's an artist.
You've got 106 or 7. I don't know if the tolls is the 107. But what are some of the other ones you're working on?
Sorry, if I may, what is the scope of what you're looking at? Like, what qualifies as maladministration, or what qualifies as irrational spending of tax money? Because, I mean, all of it is, at the end of the day, whether you spend it on the car train legitimately or on a Kandla, to me, the fact that it's spent so-called well is irrespective of the fact that they still stole it from citizens. Yeah. So what qualifies for purposes?
Let me put it this way. There's no shortage of work for us. So when we went in 2016 down this new road, we sat down, we said, what are we going to do and how are we going to do this? And it was about trying to mirror government departments. So we opened up four portfolios, two initially. It was energy and transport. And transport because of the toll matter. And it's well beyond tolls. The transport we're dealing with, the R2 amendment bill. We're dealing with long-distance toll concessions. I don't want to tell you what's going on there, but we are grossly overpaying on all these boom-down tolled routes and a number of other projects in that space. Then we deal with energy. I mean, just NERSA and the electricity tariff increases and how Eskom goes about justifying through its regulatory asset-based claims. And NERSA have just allowed them to get this massive 400% increase in 10 years and crippling business now as a result of this. Then we've opened water and environment and other special projects, education. We're working on a big CETA project now, the CETAs that are going mad. We've got Dudumnyeni, delinquent director case, quite an expensive one, to hold her to account for how she trashed SAA. We've stopped boutique companies from earning millions and gone into the whole Gupta leaks. We're one of the first recipients of that disc, put it into a very, very clever IT system that enabled us to strip out the PDF files within and search within mails. Our submissions, by the way, to the Zonda Commission are the biggest and probably the only civil action movement that's giving the extent that we have. They're relying on, we're just busy finishing the Transnet submission now. It's massive. It's a 200-pager with another probably 700 pages of annexures. So our work is around looking at national government and working with whistleblowers. Whistleblowers are brilliant. They've got all the information we need to then ask government. And what we do is we don't go and beat the door down. We do investigations. We've got a 5-step methodology: investigate, engage, expose, mobilize, and litigate if need be. And while litigate, and that's why we have our own legal team, an advocate, chief legal officer, and seven lawyers. Because we learnt on the ETOL matter, all we did was make external legal companies massively rich, and we've learnt a lot about how legal firms get rich through interlocutories, and five court cases come out of one. But just coming back to, so we build cases very fast, affidavits, we're able to interdict quickly at low cost, and we get the information, and then we ask the government, we ask the Minister of Water Affairs, and what is happening in your department? Tell us about these appointments. And then we see the behavior change. If it doesn't, we expose it and we come after them. And the beauty of what we do is we hold the individual to account. So if you are part of the problem, if you know of the corruption, maladministration, you do nothing about it, the law is strong. You're guilty. So we go after them. We attach their houses, their cars. We make they feel the pain, and the pain burns upward, because we also ask their boss, what are you doing about it? And so we start to see behavior change. But look, there's so much that we just cannot get to all the stuff that's coming.
Because my next question is going to be, Dudumnyeni, for example, she was appointed. It's a split decision by whoever appointed. Was it Jacob Zuma who appointed her to the board?
It was, yes.
Right. No, it takes him a split second to sign the paper to say you're appointed. It takes someone like Outer, how long has it been? Three, four, 5 years?
Yeah, it took a long time to. Well, she had to.
There's such a. The asymmetry is completely off balance here. How do we. I mean, There must be, it cost you millions of rands to undo the decision that took him a split second to make. Mm.
But you can't not do it. That's the thing.
Understood. But why, if I may ask, wouldn't it be better to have that decision be made more transparently in the first place?
Can you see what's happening now with the NPA head, where media are now allowed to be part of and influence that decision? You can bet your bottom dollar the next public protector, the public are going to be more involved in those appointments. Private member bills being put now to Parliament. We've put one in that says stop this public engagement over Christmas periods. No more public engagement going out before the 15th or the 10th of December to the 15th of Jan because people are away. They're not applying their minds. So all of this is exactly influencing what you're saying. How do we fix it up front to stop the nonsense from in the first place? And that's a journey in itself.
I mean, I have to say just on public engagement that I think the entire public engagement process is an absolute farce on everything. Mm. We've just seen on the expropriation without compensation stuff that Parliament has ignored pretty much 99% of the submissions. Mm. Somewhere in the more than 500,000 essentially submissions, I think somewhere in the region of 700,000 written submissions to Parliament, if I'm not mistaken. Mm. And the sense I get is that government knows where they want to go, and then they just find their sort of route there. And they do sometimes what they kind of have to, inverted commas, but they don't really care. And also, I might add that even if the public engagement on something like expropriation without compensation had been positive. So let's say the 700,000 submissions had all been four, but they went around the country and they had these sort of town halls. We've seen how this is being manipulated. Political parties bussing people in. Mm. I looked at where those various things were. They were at times of the day anyone who works a reasonable work day would not be able to attend. In addition, how do you justify when we have an election? We of the registered voters, only about 60% actually vote, and that's not tens of millions, but 10 to 15 million people. When you have a public engagement process, we have a few thousand people. How is that at all representative? We know from polling, for example, if you did a poll that way, the way they run those public engagements, it would be methodologically, it'd be completely irrelevant, the findings. Yeah. So I just think it's a farce.
Yeah, look, the law is clear. They've got to do meaningful public engagement, and that you're quite right. That's where it just falls over. I mean, the whole Archer Amendment Bill, and this is where they want to try and force other issues into play around, and e-tolling is one of them. They had public engagement sessions, and we went to them. We went to as many as we could. And there were, like, some of the meetings, 20 people in the hall, and they didn't know why they were there. And it was this is what we're going to do. And then the questions were just so irrelevant. When we put our hands up and said, guys, can we ask some questions, just empower the people here to understand what's going on? No, sit down. You know, we've seen you before. We've heard you. No, these people haven't. And then it was a case of, right, this is what we're going to do. It's all going to be nice. But guys, we've got to finish off because there's food over there. Anybody, yes, in favor? And I've got to eat now. You know, there's free food. Let's go and eat. And let's not get into the meat of the discussion. That's what's happened. So again, another farce. That's what happened on the e-toll matter. The e-toll matter, they had one advert.
Mm.
I put it in 6 newspapers, I hid them in the business section, so vague, and they got 28 responses. And there are 3.5 million motorists in Gauteng, and they ticked the box of engagement, public engagement. What a farce. Mm. And then they wonder why is everybody angry? Why, what's going on here?
And then they hired all their celebrities to say, I play e-tolls.
Yeah.
Only to find out after the fact, like 2 years later, Tivo Touch was one of them. He came out and said, no, I never paid. They just paid me to say that. It is the whole thing. So how is your engagement with the actual officials that you're fighting with? Or when you speak to someone from the state who you disagree with on a fundamental level, are these people like aware? that they're doing wrong? Is there an overriding sense of megalomania throughout, or are they understanding?
Initially, they when this happened and it blew up in their faces and business and everybody was saying, what's going on? They got together an interministerial committee under Gilemo Motlanthe and we got around the table and we said, yeah, but are you listening? This is what's happening. This is why we... And they said, yeah, okay, now we've heard you, but I don't know whether it was a case of too many of us are going to lose some money, because there's a number of companies that feed off this revenue stream from ETOL. So you must know that if you've got the security contract or the catering contract, I mean, there's good money here. So they decided to, let it, it's going to go ahead. So we're going to let it go ahead. So we said, fine, let's let it go ahead. And when the first person summons, we'll have to defend them and then show you in the court of law why this is unlawful. Because the administrative law is now set aside, which allowed SANRAL to carry on when we first challenged it, because we'd bought it too late. And 180 days had gone, roads are tarred, the money had been borrowed. So we said, fine. But what a judge has to do is now consider the legality properly if I'm going to criminalize you or go after you as an individual. So when it comes to meeting the leadership, I can sit here and tell you right now, 5 years after failure, no minister of transport has sat with us yet and tried to understand what our issue is. Cyril Ramaphosa hasn't, but he's been part of the decision. And if they launch a new amnesty on this, again, it's just a reset, and we'll be here again in a couple of years. So sadly, they're not engaging. They see civil society, their critics, as enemies for some reason. They don't think that hey, we're actually passionate about this country. We are so keen for government to work. That's why we fight them when they get it wrong. They just see us as, but you guys are just throwing stones and poking sticks at us for no reason.
Yeah, but Wayne, I mean with respect, unless you understand the National Democratic Revolution, they would see you as enemies. You are thwarting the revolution. You are thwarting the vanguard of the masses.
Yeah. So I'm not sure if you've ever tried to remove a pig from a full trough. It's while it is feeding.
It is
going to be very difficult. But you're talking about the tolling engagement. You mentioned the presser, I think you. But are you busy with the locomotives and that side of things?
Yeah, that's
so. I mean, that was the one where they bought locomotives that didn't fit on our tracks. What's the progress on that? Has anyone been punished for that? You're mentioning people going after people, but you know, are we going to see the Dudumienis, Brian Molefis, these people? And there was another with a guy that was involved with the locomotives.
Lucky Montana.
Richard Seleke, Dan. I mean, there's tons of them. The short answer to that question is, if the rule of law is allowed to take its course, yes, they will all go to jail. Now, so the question is, well, why isn't the rule of law being applied?
And why does it take so long?
Yes, and that is turning. Actually, we're quite positive. We're working behind the scenes with a number of institutions that can make all of this happen. And there's suddenly an appetite because Cyril's in, and all the barriers that Zuma had put in are now being dismantled. They take a while. But the question that the ANC now has to answer is, well, if the rule of law runs its course, we have to look around and say 80% of us, possibly, and talking in leadership structures who have been feeding from this trough, might have to go and wear an orange overall. So what do we do? How do we do this? And our view is that there's possibly a need to introduce a what we call a corruption amnesty. But before you even do that, put in place the corruption courts, the whole process of allowing information to flow, be verified, answer the question yes or no. If you were amnesty, if you bring back all the cash, the only thing you'll trade then is not to wear orange overalls, but live with the fact you've got no more money and try to be clean and the shame that you've been participating. That's big. It's big. We've done the truth and reconciliations before. We can do this. Know that if you do it seriously, Afghanistan, Georgia, a number of countries, you got to go deep to root out corruption and be radical about it. And that's the option that Cyril's got to consider. But he's got to get through an election first in 6 months' time. He's surrounded by really dubious characters. And I guess he's playing a game of chess with one eye closed and a bright light in the other eye and one hand tied behind his back. And
if you believe he's not a dubious character himself.
Damn it, Jonathan. I was about to say that.
Yeah.
he's one of them.
And then you've got that element. So where do we go? Well, we've got to also
Let's remember that the architect of the first major corrupt deal that we know of in the new South Africa, which was the arms deal, became the president. Mm. And all of his co-conspirators in that deal became ministers of cabinet, heads of SOEs. Yeah. So I'm just probably more pessimistic. I'm grateful that there are people like you who are chasing it regardless. Mm. I'm just more pessimistic.
It makes our job harder. But we've got to take the opportunity. And let me put it to you this way. Pravin Gordhan was against us and in court on the ETAR matter as the Minister of Finance. Very adamant that they had to do that. That's fine. And we were arch enemies at that stage. We sat with them the first time in his office trying to find a solution, but we could see what was wrong. Today, Pravin is a friend of ATA. He's a person who commends us in Parliament because of the work that we've done. He's seen that we are genuine and we're sincere about the bigger picture issues. And we can disagree on one thing, but ATA's role is meaningful. And so, yeah.
I wouldn't trust him as far as I could throw him.
And he's a heavy set man.
He's a heavy set man. When the rest of cabinets go to Cubana to drink tequila, he's at home writing communist propaganda.
Well,
often called policy.
We look beyond all of that and just say, who are the best people that we can work with in government to try and get something done? And he's a good guy in that sense. You know, Popo Molefe, who was at PRAS, who's now at Transnet, these are the guys that were removed because they were doing good work or back in. So there's a lot of good signs, and we have to work with the best people we can.
What's your energy side of things finding in terms of Eskom? Because we're currently being threatened by Eskom again. Mm. I'm so tired of being threatened by the government. I wish I had the power.
It's like being called racist 500 times a day
to remove them. But I think on many of these issues, a lot of South African citizens, regardless of how they vote, are very tired of being threatened with. You know, we do everything they ask, not because we want to necessarily, but because under the force of a gun usually. But the point is they 2008-09 the power crisis happens. They have what essentially is 100 to 200% increases in electricity over the next 3 years. Mm-hmm. They then want more and they want more and then they collapse and then they sell half of their capacity to the Guptas in terms of coal provision.
And let's not forget, they built two power stations that are still not online, Kusile and...
Now four times the price that you could have got that on the...
Which they claim we don't need, but then we now are being, as I say, threatened again for the umpteenth time that we're going to run out of energy. Any input on the energy side of things?
Yeah, look, I mean, we've got an energy division and a department, and I can tell you now the Eskom story is tragic. It is absolutely horrible what happened there. But essentially, a very efficient energy producer, dirty coal still in those days, tied collieries, lowest cost, great energy cost, one of the lowest in the world, very efficient. And then comes a new leadership that says, well, how do you rate the system? This is it. State-owned entities is where the big capital expenditure projects go. So okay, we need new power station, Medupi. Now, Medupi, a similar power station built in India at 38 billion rand equivalent. Right, you've got a budget of 70 billion, 79 billion. Go. Oh, wait, can't we have two of these? Literally, yeah, that's a good idea. Let's do Kusile as well. And then let's start and never end and never end. And you know, you see Chancellor House, for instance, whoa, hold off on the boiler tender. Hold on. We just want to buy some shares quickly in Hitachi. Okay. They've got it. go. Now, attach, you got the tender. And so it starts. And then you just see this, what was supposed to be a doubled price, 78 billion rand. That project, if it ends, will be a 200 to 300 billion rand project. When it gets to an end eventually. Right now, it makes sense to just not spend another cent.
So let's, you're saying 200 to 300. I'm going to round it up to 500 billion because I think by the time it's done for both of them, that's probably the cost you're going to be looking at.
Yeah, no, this would be.
And people were freaking out about a 1 trillion rand nuclear deal, and nuclear is at least clean. That's actually been recently admitted by the climate scientists.
Would have been two.
I agree with you, but I'm just pointing out that
it's horrible.
But even our media engagement on this has been poor because
A guy like Chris Yelland has been brilliant.
Yes, I agree with you. I think you know Chris has been very good on this, but I'm talking about mainstream media. The people are driving in their cars every day. Whatever they're listening to, whatever they're tuning into, and there's hysteria over the nuclear deal, and I don't hear nearly as much hysteria over.
Well, it's sad, and so what's happened is it's failed, and they borrowed 300 billion that they shouldn't have, and they didn't need it because, by the way, they went to the public and said, "The nurse, are we going to get these tariff hikes to pay for this stuff?" And then they also went to the. But this is the biggest sin in all these state-owned institutions. They went to the finance houses and said, "We need money." The finance says, but you're getting the money from your tariff increases. But what the finances are, come back to the greed. The finance houses said, okay, but let's have a look at your balance sheets. And all these state-owned institutions, SANRAL, Eskom, Transnet, Danel, look at them. If you go back and we've done this work in their balance sheets, they revalued their assets according to international accounting standards, which you can if they are, but that's where the question is, it's dubious revaluation. Balance sheet looks good. They go to the finance houses and say, look, we'd like to borrow some money. What do you want to do? You want to build roads, power stations? Okay, your balance sheet looks exciting. And are you going to give us government guarantees on these? Yes. Shit, how much do you want? Literally, how much do you want? Yeah, now they've got this debt.
The guaranteed loan against...
The debts of those four state-owned institutions, over 500 billion rand additional debt that they didn't need. And now they can't settle that. And Eskom is poked. It's absolutely stuffed. It has got, it's a death spiral. They're coming now with another 15% increase request. On top of that, the clawback request, 30% increase in total, probably only going to get about 25, which is still massive on top of where they are now, 400% higher than they were 10 years ago. And the people are saying, well, stuff you, we're going off grid. So you will never build now. No new houses and towns and that can be built will be built on Eskom Energy. So it shot itself in the head.
That's a wonderful thing, Wayne.
Yeah.
I think these things should crash and burn. Yeah. As much as possible. Hold on.
Okay.
What have you got to say?
I wanted to ask on that point is where Arta stands on supporting moves towards
renewable energy.
Not renewable.
Secession.
Towards any kind of private takeover. So, for example, on Eskom, a lot of what's restricting us from having private companies enter the market is legislation that prevents them from basically competing with Eskom. So,
that's going to be challenged. But and you know what? It's not really the case. You will not build. If you build a house in the next year and you're still on the Eskom grid, you're crazy. It's cheaper now to be off the grid with a little bit of gas and a battery backup through solar. You do not need Eskom. I know people who've built houses.
Sure.
Now, so you're off the grid. And if you get your water...
But some people, I mean, that's at different levels. And I think that some people will be able to afford that. Solar is becoming cheaper, but it's still costly relatively. Batteries are. And there's other... hidden costs in that, in terms of replacement, etc. Over time,
it's not there. It's gone beyond that now. It's cheaper.
Yes.
If you built a new house, it would be cheaper to put the solar in and the batteries than connecting to an Eskom. So we see people now saying to Eskom, "No thanks. I don't need your connection. I don't want it." And that's happening.
Sure, but perhaps in Eskom and perhaps there are solutions there to bypass it. But I still think that in terms of, tax abuse. One of the ways to solve tax abuse would be to have less of these institutions which are bound to end up in corruption. Enforcing it. Water is another example. We can't have water privatization in the country, really. There's rules against that as well.
We challenge those, and they are being challenged, and so I wouldn't worry about that, because the reality is the world's just going to move that way fast. I agree with you. Business, a government should get out of the business of business. In other words, governments cannot compete. So you get an SAA and you get other airlines. Well, SAA has failed. It'll never succeed, and even around the world. So stop flying airplanes, government. You don't need a flag on the tail of an airplane to provide this service. So get out of it. But SAA is so stuffed, nobody will buy it. So it's defunct. You don't need to be in the business of providing telecoms, which is why they've done the right thing in telecom. You don't need to be in the business of making it steel. That's why ISCOR became ArcelorMittal. Get out of it. It's not your game.
Yeah.
And that's happening more and more. And the beauty of where all these state-owned institutions are right now is government's got no choice but to sell them. Danelle, we don't need to make arms. Give that to the people that compete and do that, arms and ammunition. It's privatize it, man. Get rid of everything. Just be a government that provides good governance structure to enable this country to become prosperous again.
Maybe we can make you a libertarian.
Well, I think we should privatize that as well, to be honest.
Yeah.
So now just
as that's happening.
What, privatizing the government?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I'm in favor of that. Just of outer you. Makosi Khoza, who became well known for disagreeing with Zuma after the eighth time of agreeing with him, and then she disagreed with him the one time, and she became a media darling because she's a strong, independent woman who took a stand against the worst president this country has had since 1994. She started her own political party. She got kicked out in that, and now she's joined OUTA as an executive director. Is there not a conflict between this person who was in your opponent's corner her whole life and now joining you?
No, I think if you listen to Makosi Khoza's story, she grew up in the struggle. She became one of the youngest mayors, deputy mayor of Pietermaritzburg. She studied total quality management, government systems, and everything. And you're in the system, you become a member of parliament, and you start to see the frustration, and you try and change things, and you raise concerns inside, and you get told to toe the party line. And you keep raising these things internally until there comes a time when you say, well, I'm now going to break ranks with the party line, and I'm going to stand up and tell the president to step down. I'm stuff the party line. Now that takes massive courage. Sure, you can say, but why didn't you do that earlier? Life is hindsight's an exact science. But you think you can make the change, and then you find yourself in a situation where you're threatened. Get out of the party. So you say, okay, what's my next option? Her next option were people wanting to help her fund, because she has the courage, a new party. So ADEC starts to get born. Then Cyril Ramaphosa comes into power, and then the funders start saying, well, are you sure about this? Why don't you go back to the party, because Cyril will invite you back in, which is what is happening, and there's a bigger role for you to play. And then her party starts being threatened. She says, I'm not sure that going back is the right thing. I met with her just by chance. We got chatting, because at that stage with her new political party, they wanted to see if there was some alliance they could have with civil society, and what was civil society doing differently? Should they be doing things differently? And my chat with Makosi was quite an interesting one. I said to her, quite frankly, Makosi, go and have a chat with Mampela Rampela and find out what are you really going to do with this new party. Are you going to get 2 seats, 3 seats, 4 seats? And what change can you bring inside politics? Listen to how we believe you can bring change when we go into local government. And this is the same strategy at national, holding people to account for abuse and maladministration in the towns. She loved the idea. We were just about to launch our local division, and she said, I'm in. If you want me to be part of this, what is that role? We sat down, and now she heads up this massive, this growing division of ours. She's passionate. She's genuine. She's studied this stuff. she loves it. She's in the right place. And this is what happens when people can see that politics is a five-year game. Every 5 years you become relevant. Civil activism is every day you are relevant. It's what we call it current democracy. We fight these things every day and we make change happen. So she's great. She's good for this brand. And she's a good person.
And I respect your very civil answer. My concern is, any organization that is not overtly principled will become corrupted over time. Mm. That has happened throughout.
Yeah.
I'm not saying she's unprincipled, on the contrary, but is it good strategy to bring in politicians to a civil society scenario? Because civil, as you said, the ANC looks at civil society as the enemy of the revolution, of their game. And for someone who's grown up in the ANC, that's going to take a hell of a lot of propaganda to get out of her head. I mean, just last week she attacked Musi for not being black enough, for example, and she apologized after the fact. But those are the elements of that African nationalism that's so prevalent in the ANC coming out of someone who's not in it anymore.
No, I don't see it as that. I see it as it's about people, not about politicians. If she is genuine in her approach, which she is, so it doesn't matter who and where, so long as the person is doing this for the right reasons. If we have another politician join us for the right reasons, I mean, we have Godfrey Galston, who's just joined us. He was the first accounting general for South Africa. He's now heading up our finance analytics inside ARTA, previously in government. So, but also prior to that in big business, he was headhunted by Trevor Manuel at the time to go into government, and now retired and contacted us and said, oh, geez, I've got time. Can I help? When we saw each other and met, we said, can you start today? And so he's joined us recently. So no, I don't see a problem. And you know, Makosi's challenge on Musi was one that came from the right, absolutely right area, because you know, this whole thing about African beer and Kumbuti was driven for a totally different narrative, and she, I think what Makosi's learned is you don't get into complex discussions like that on Twitter, because you'll get eaten up, and that's what happened. It was good learning for her. And it wasn't meant to come out the way she did, so she apologized. So now look, she's right for this brand.
I'm not at all telling you what to do by any means, but I would, if I had an organization, I'd be very wary about letting anyone.
Okay, so the bigger question on top of that then is, as you grow and as more people come in, and as you've got Makosi Khoza and previous auditor generals and who knows what, how do you maintain transparency?
Mm-hmm.
So that those people aren't and not casting any aspersions on the people that you have, but if the ANC were clever, they would put a few moles in your organization, frankly. So how do you keep transparency, and how do you keep the ship on the right path?
Well, we've got to be open. We put on our website our annual statements, our annual report is there. We give a breakdown of our revenue, how much we earn, and what is spent on salaries. And I mean, we're a non-profit organization. There's no shareholding. Everything goes back into the organization. Mm. The more we earn, the more people we employ, the more work we can do. It's as simple as that.
Okay.
We have a litigation war chest. You have to have money in a provision account so that you can fight fast. You can't say, okay, we're going to go and interdict something and say we're just going to go and raise a few million rand for this case and get to it 2 years down the line. Mm. So that's how we operate. Bringing people in, we scrutinize, we check. And we've got our IT processes that make sure, and our investigations team that make sure that we bring in the right people. But there's no doubt that potentially somebody could get in. We have had one or two situations where some of our stuff that we're doing went back to a
director that we'd fired because there was somebody sympathetic inside, and this person was building a smear campaign against us. So you find that, you weed that out, and you don't need to spend too much time on that. We do trust our people. Our people are passionate, but at the end of the day, you can't fight. You can't fight this game. You can't play this game with fear, and they can't fight the truth. So even though, let's say, and we said to the Hawks when we heard that they were, a bit worried about what information we had, said, come and have a look at our computers. Don't have to raid us. You can come in, have a look. You can put somebody to sit next to me. I'll show you every mail we sent out. I'll show you what our strategies are, because you must know them. All we're going to do is go after people that are corrupt. And you can't stop that. You can't fight. You can't fight us in a manner that you're going to try and upset us, because you know our game plan ahead of time. Our game plan's not going to stop.
Cool. Ramon?
Well, no. I approve deeply of organizations like Outer, because you're funded by ordinary people, and that, I think that brings a whole different asymmetry in it, rather than being funded by corporates or other NGOs or the George Soros Foundation for Democracy or whatever he calls it these days. The accountability is far more acute, and you feel it far more because your members are the people within your vicinity, and you have to be held accountable to them. I think it's a great way to get money and do your job properly. And I wish out all the best. This has been really illuminating. And we'll be more than happy to have you back in the future. And best of luck in
any
what
time,
you do.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And just know that the more we have, the more we can do. So we need more people on board, because we don't have enough.
I think there should be like a super NGO where all of them just get together.
We've tried that. It's like herding cats. It cannot happen. Everyone's got different agendas, different egos, different mandates. It's a madness. So it's almost like this competitive space out there. Shouldn't be the case.
Competition always arises, even if it doesn't really exist.
We're all chasing the same buck.
But the more that exists, the merrier.
Yeah, absolutely.
And good luck. I mean, as a CEO of a cushy, as you said, having a cushy job going to this, it's a kick in the face at the best of times.
It's been fun. great energy and good people.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for joining us, and we appreciate it. You want to punt any of the sites or anything?
How do we join you?
Yeah, look, it takes 5 minutes, please. It's www.outa.co.za. If people can just click on the join button and sign up a debit order. Anytime you want to cancel it, you can. Any amount you want, 80 Rand a month. Our average is 140 Rand a month. Please, because don't think that your 140 will make no difference. If everybody felt that way, we wouldn't be where we are. The more people we get on board, the more we can employ and the more we can do. We want to open up our health and education portfolios now. So, please, outa.co.za.
Yeah, and if you need an anarchist portfolio, I'm available to run it.
Lovely. Anarchist.
The Outer Republic of Transparency or something.
Yeah, all right, good. So, health is in desperate need of someone to challenge, although credit to Jack Bloom, who has done a lot of good work.
And Section 27, Mark Hayward, they've been doing a great job.
Some of that, but ideologically driven, which is my problem with them. But separate discussion for another time. Thank you so much for joining us. That's Wayne Duvenage. You can find us on Twitter @Renegade_Report, on Facebook, both the page and the group. Come join us. We have good discussions. If you enjoy the show and you're able to, you can become a patron. Lots of rewards and things coming for patrons in the future, and currently there at the moment. We appreciate all of you who do listen to the show and donate to the show. Thanks so much. We'll catch you next time. Cheers.
This is CliffCentral.com.